legal counsel, you don't have anything for us at this time, do you? Christina?
I don't.
Okay. We typically do ask if there's been any, if there's any conflict of interest or ex parte.
Ex parte contacts do not apply to legislative proposals such as this one.
Okay.
Conflicts of interest do continue to apply, that's correct.
Okay. So any conflicts of interest that we need to declare at this time, Commission?
No, Commissioners.
I have none. Okay. All right. And so at this time, I'll go ahead and open the public hearing. Public hearing is open, and we will begin with our staff presentation. Sandy Belson, Compensative Planning Manager. If you could please step up and provide the staff's information.
Good evening, Commissioners.
Good evening.
So I'm going to provide you some context for the proposed amendments, take you through the major proposed changes, and then the findings for criteria, the comments we've received thus far, and then some responses to that. So first of all, can everybody in the audience hear me? Okay, great. I thought this was going to work.
Look on the side and see if that's turned on.
Yes, does help to turn it on. Okay, so encouraging construction of accessory dwelling units is part of the City Council's affordable housing strategy. And just to provide that context, some other components to address housing throughout the continuum is to expand the overnight parking program, to contribute to income-qualified housing development, and that is using our home funds, federal funds that we use in conjunction with the City of Eugene as part of the Home Consortium. Encouraging those accessory dwelling units. We are looking to secure property targeted for residential development, and this is to capitalize on the community development block grant funds that the city receives, and also looking at publicly owned property that we could target for residential development. We assist homeowners with community development block grant funds, both for home ownership assistance through our SHOP program, Springfield Home Ownership, in which we provide down payment assistance to qualifying property owners, and we also provide low-income homeowners with funds to address repairs or accessibility improvements necessary for them to maintain safe and secure housing. And finally, we are looking to promote a housing of diverse types. So again, in terms of accessory dwelling units, there are three ways that we are looking at encouraging them. One is that the City Council temporarily waive system development charges for accessory dwelling units. We are currently promoting awareness and the possibilities for accessory dwelling units, and then the reason we are here tonight is to look at revising the development code to make it easier and potentially less expensive for homeowners to add an accessory dwelling unit. So considerations as we're going forward with these proposed code amendments is that we want to, on one hand, encourage development of ADUs, or accessory dwelling units, within the city while by reducing regulatory hurdles. But we also want to protect the character of existing neighborhoods within the city. And so finding that balance is your task tonight. So briefly to go through the major changes, and these are not all of them, but these are the substantive changes that are being put forth to you, is that we are looking at allowing accessory dwelling units in the Washburn Historic District. We are also looking at allowing them in the medium and high density residential zones. So in the medium and high density zones, we would allow one or two, depending on what is necessary to meet the minimum density requirements, which means there would be a maximum lot size that would allow accessory dwellings. That way we maintain the development potential of those medium and high density zoning districts. Looking at removing the minimum size requirement, which is currently at 300 square feet. So The example we have here is a home at Emerald Village, and all of the homes in Emerald Village are less than 300 square feet, so maybe we should allow that size home here as well. Related to size is the ratio requirement that is currently in the code, whereby accessory dwelling units cannot exceed 40% of the size of the primary dwelling. So this is an example in Portland where the primary dwelling, 40% of that would not have allowed the size of accessory dwelling unit behind, even though it's less than the maximum size of 750 square feet. Looking at allowing an existing small dwelling, like the one in yellow there in the front, to become the accessory dwelling if it is less than 750 square feet, excluding garage, and then you would build a primary building elsewhere on the lot. We are looking at allowing more flexibility in the location of the entrance to the accessory dwelling unit. So in this case, there is an accessory dwelling below and the primary dwelling is above, and both front doors are facing the same street. Now, we are including in the code for the Washburn District a recommendation to not allow both entrances to be on the same size, same side if it's in the same building. We are looking at waiving on-site parking requirements for accessory dwelling units if there is on-street parking available, and that on-street parking will continue to be available based on our adopted plans. And we are looking at allowing unpaved parking if you're providing parking on-site and there's a paved driveway that is at least 18 feet long from the property line that serves that parking space. Now, this photo does not show an 18-foot paved driveway, but it gives you the idea of what we're looking at there. We are removing the requirement for the property owner to live on site. That way, both units would actually have the potential to become rentals. We are looking at allowing manufactured homes, the small size that would be under that 750 square feet maximum, and approved towable structures as an accessory dwelling, as long as those towable structures were permitted, inspected, and approved by the local authority. In other words, they would meet building code standards for a permanent dwelling. At the last work session, you had recommended that those be placed on a permanent foundation, and so I've got some language I'll hand out a little bit later, some options of how you could address that. As with anything in the historic district, those new homes would meet the district's alteration standards, and we had added an explicit statement not to allow manufactured homes in the Washburn district, so that there's no question about whether a manufactured home would meet those alteration standards. We're also looking at allowing more flexibility in meeting design requirements. Currently, the design requirements are that the accessory dwelling unit must match the primary in materials and design. So we're allowing that approach, but also allowing another option if they meet some basic standards that they could gain approval for that accessory dwelling. Again, in the historic district, any accessory dwelling units must still meet the alteration standards. So the approval criteria, and all testimony should be addressed to approval criteria so that you can evaluate that testimony based on whether it meets the requirements. So the approval criteria comes from Springfield Development Code 5.6-115. In reaching a decision on the amendment of this code's text, the City Council shall adopt findings that demonstrate conformance to the following: the Metro Plan, applicable state statutes, applicable statewide planning goals, and administrative rules. So I'm going to take you through those. In our case, we actually have two components of the Metro Plan. There's the Metro Plan itself, which is the Eugene Springfield applicable comprehensive plan. And so the criteria for citizen involvement is to improve and maintain local mechanisms that provide the opportunity for residents and property owners in existing residential areas to participate in the implementation of policies in the metro plan that may affect the character of those areas. So as this committee for citizen involvement, you reviewed and approved a citizen involvement plan, and so we are following the provisions in that citizen involvement plan in getting the word out and getting comments. We also complied with the Springfield Development Code 5.2-115B, which requires notice in the register guard of the public hearing. So for the residential land use and housing element in the metro plan, there are several policies that apply to residential density. To promote higher residential density inside the urban growth boundary that utilizes existing infrastructure, improves the efficiency of public services and facilities, and conserves rural resource lands outside the urban growth boundary. A13, to increase overall residential density in the metropolitan area by creating more opportunities for effectively designed infill, redevelopment, and mixed use, while considering impacts of increased residential density on historic, existing, and future neighborhoods. A14, review local zoning and development regulations periodically to remove barriers to higher density housing and to make provision for a full range of housing options. A16, allow for the development of zoning districts which allow overlap of the established metro plan density ranges to promote housing choice and result in either maintaining or increasing housing density in those districts. Under no circumstances shall housing densities be allowed below existing metro plan density ranges. Policies that address housing type and tenure are A17, provide opportunities for a full range of choice of housing type, density, size, cost, and location. And A18, encourage a mix of structure types and densities within residential designations by reviewing and, if necessary, amending local zoning and development regulations. Policy about affordable special need and fair housing to consider local zoning and development regulations' impact on the cost of housing. So the other component of our comprehensive plan, which is a refinement plan of the metro plan, is the Springfield 2030 comprehensive plan. And we have a residential land use and housing element adopted specifically for Springfield. So policies in that plan that apply to growth and needed housing are H6, continue to seek ways to reduce development impediments to more efficient utilization of the residential land supply inside the UGB, especially in the city's sloped areas, Southeast Springfield and Willamette Heights. In terms of fostering housing choice and affordability, we have policy H9, provide a broad range of quality, accessible, and affordable housing options for very low, low, and moderate income residents. Affordable housing is defined as housing for which persons or families pay 30% or less of their gross income for housing, including necessary and essential utilities. The policies to encourage housing diversity and quality neighborhoods. H11, continue to seek ways to update development standards to introduce a variety of housing options for all income levels in both existing neighborhoods and new residential areas that match the changing demographics and lifestyles of Springfield residents. And H15, update residential development standards to enhance the quality and affordability of neighborhood infill development, such as partitions, duplex developments, transitional neighborhoods, rehab housing, accessory dwelling units, and multifamily development. So as you can see, we have a lot of supporting policies for the efforts before you tonight to add accessory dwelling units, looking at the development regulations, their effect on neighborhoods, and the affordability thereof, and the design elements. There's also a relevant policy from the Springfield 2030 Transportation System Plan. Policy 2.6, to manage the on-street parking system to preserve adequate capacity and turnover for surrounding land uses. So again, those are the criteria that we've identified from our comprehensive plan that are applicable to your recommendation to City Council. There are also state statutes. We have ORS 197.3125A and B. And this was passed by the recent legislative session, in which we are now required to allow accessory dwellings in areas zoned for detached single-family dwellings, subject to reasonable local regulations relating to siting and design. As part of that same bill passed by the recent legislature, we have ORS 197.3074BA, that a city may not deny an application for housing development located within the urban growth boundary if the development complies with clear and objective standards, including but not limited to clear and objective design standards contained in the city comprehensive plan or land use regulations. This paragraph does not apply to, and what it's referencing there applies to the historic districts. So in the historic district, you are not required to have the clear and objective standards that you would for needed housing elsewhere in the city. But do keep that in mind, that any standards we do have for accessory dwelling units must meet that clear and objective requirement if they apply citywide. So as I mentioned before, we've had citizen involvement throughout this process, and I'm going to go through some of the highlights from that. And we had a recommendation from the Historic Commission. The Historic Commission met on September 26th, and a letter from the chair regarding their recommendations on allowing accessory dwelling units in the Washburn District is before you. We had an open house on September 28th. We had 36 people sign in, and those comments are also in your packet. So the comments that people provided, either in sticky notes or in comment forms, are included in your packet. We've had three correspondents come in prior to the hearing tonight. I'm sorry, four. One was a little bit after five, so I forgot about it. We have an email from Chantel Buss, who supports the accessory dwellings and is a owner in the Washburn Historic District. We have an email from Craig Patterson. His comments were specific to House Bill 2737, which is related to building codes for small homes. He wanted those comments included in the record for this decision as well. We have a letter from the Fair Housing Council with a follow-on email stating that they believe that we need to approve our findings for compliance with Goal 10. And I do agree that we should probably add a finding that states the impact of accessory dwelling units on our buildable lands inventory, basically that there is not a detrimental impact, that it's not taking up any additional land by allowing these accessory dwelling units that's needed to meet our future housing needs for the buildable lands inventory. And then we have a letter from the Lane County Transportation Planning Division, and they are in support of the proposed amendments, even those that would allow the on-street parking on county roads. So to follow on with that, I have processed some of the comments that you had brought up at your last work session and prepared a handout that addresses some of those, and then some other issues that come up as you start working on one issue, you realize, oh yes, there's this tentacle over here that reaches and touches that. So we're continuing to refine those. So Brenda Jones is handing those out. So for the benefit of the public, I'll just identify quickly what those are. So realized that it was not clear that the minimum setbacks, how they would apply to accessory dwelling units. So we decided to add language that state that the minimum setbacks for primary structures would also apply to accessory dwelling units. Second item, I think a planning commissioner had brought up in the Washburn Historic District, if you already have a house with two entry doors on facing one street, what would happen then? So we worked at reworking some of the language to account for an existing condition, but that no new door would be added or an accessory dwelling unit on the same side in the same building. I've got a couple options there for you in terms of language that could be considered for requiring a manufactured home or towable structure to be on a foundation. So you could look those over and decide which works best. And then we talked about windows last time in terms of the design requirements. I looked, I didn't find any other good examples. I don't have any great ideas about design for windows other than the trim. But in looking at that, decided that actually there's a different issue, and that's around privacy. So especially if you're building a second floor accessory dwelling, that might cause some concerns with neighbors. So propose some language that would require, and I'll just read it for the public, that the second story windows facing the nearest side or rear yard shall use opaque or side obscuring glass, or if clear glass, the bottom of the window shall be 5 feet or more above the floor elevation. This provision does not apply when the windows face an abutting garage or building wall where no windows exist. And then that balconies on the second floor or higher are not permitted within the yard setback area unless the balcony faces an abutting garage. We also got comments from one of the commissioners. I already had it up here. So Commissioner Koivula, did I pronounce that correctly? Okay. So he has continued the discussion about parking issues. I think I don't have a clear response at this point, but I think it's worth continuing discussion. I can say that in terms of alley access, the city's policy is that if there's a new development that's taking access from an unpaved alley, that they would be brought up to city standards. That's a general city policy that applies broadly. So how that gets applied to accessory dwelling units, I'm not prepared to go into the distinction about that. But if you have questions about generally how do we deal with development citywide, you know, we can go into those. The next is in terms of on-street parking, and concern about allowing that on-street parking that could be an impediment in certain areas of the city to through traffic or emergency response. He brought up issues about aesthetic concerns with the windows. I mean, about the doorways, which I think maybe I've addressed, maybe not. Then under his aesthetic concerns, number two, wondering if concrete siding products and stucco are prohibited. I think that's a good question. I think we could add those to the allowed materials for accessory dwellings. He raised questions about the windows, whether all windows should have trim. So I would say in the proposal, there's the option to either match the existing housing, so how the windows are treated on the existing housing, or provide windows with trim. If you do not think that we should require trim, does that mean we would remove the standard, or do you want to add another process for discretionary review, which would allow the development or the director to make a decision or have some other kind of standard other than the clear and objective standard?
And to clarify on that, that would have implications for the process,
right,
and the type of decision that would be being made potentially.
And under his miscellaneous notes, I agree with those. He has a wording change for a finding, adding some additional submittal requirements, and then bulleting, instead of bulleting the comments in the open house, to number them so they're easier to reference. So with that, I will conclude my staff report, and then you can go to public testimony.
All right. Thank you. Okay. We have several public testimony requests. We like to keep our public testimony concise and try not to repeat things that have already been said. We allow 3 minutes for public testimony. However, this is a legislative process. We're about gathering information from the public, so certainly we could waive that. If we get into discussion, it could go longer than that. So with that being said, could Chris
McAllister,
please step forward, state your name and address for the commission, and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, esteemed commission. My name is Chris McAllister. I live at 1909 12th Street, Springfield, in Ward 3. I'd like to share a couple thoughts in regards to this. First of all, I'd like to say thank you to Ms. Belson for the work that she's put through on this as a member of the Poverty and Homeless Board, as well as an affiliate with the Shelter Rights Alliance. I've been looking into housing options in Springfield for quite a bit. And I'd like to draw attention to support for the final 4 points on the general process, which is allowing more flexibility for the location of the entrance. I feel like this would particularly benefit me in my neighborhood. I live right off of Piedmont, and so I live on a corner of Hodge, and current rules make it too hard for me to convert my shop into an ADU, though it would actually help my income and help me house several family members. I recently hospiced my mother, and having an extra place that's separated from the house would have been a lot easier for our family in that process. I feel like there's a pathway in this to be able to do something like that. With that in mind, I'd also like to speak in support to the waiving the on-site parking requirement and the unpaved parking space on site if there's an 18-foot lead-in. I'm losing a neighbor because of an ordinance issue based on this very issue. He moved his RV to a gravel parking spot for a day and a half, and someone was able to get a complaint in by that time, and so he got a letter, and needless to say, he's moving out of Springfield over this one issue regarding a parking on RV for temporary. So I think that there's room for all Springfielders to improve, not just those who need an ADU, with some of these changes. In addition to that, I'd like to show great support for the removing the requirement of the property owner to live on site. I feel like there's a lot of people who invest in Springfield who don't necessarily live here, or that live in the UGB or other areas that they would like to see things advance. And I feel like this sets a great way to include both those who are going to be part of our process and those who don't necessarily get to choose, such as those who will be in the park renovations in Glenwood once we figure out what we're doing with all that housing. So this would make more people able to stay in our local area, which I think helps Springfield and keeps us local. So I'd like to thank you again for your time, and Ms. Belson for her work.
Thank you, Chris. Okay, next, Rick Satry. You've done this a time or two, Rick. I think you probably know the rules of the road. Name and address, please.
Thank you, commissioners. My name's Rick Satry. I live at 1326 Wimbledon Place in Springfield. Speaking tonight not as a representative of my firm or any clients, but as an individual, as a land use planner, as a landscape architect, and as a longtime Springfield resident. I'm speaking in support of the proposed code amendments. So allow me to say just a couple of things as to why. One, the land supply is constrained. It's not new information for any of us necessarily in this room. Oregon land use law, urban growth boundaries, and such tend to imbalance the normal economic equation. So when demand is strong, land supply is limited, tends to drive up costs, tends to limit or reduce availability, reduce options that folks have in terms of looking for housing. This proposed code amendment does something about this inequality or inequity in terms of supply, demand, and the negative results of availability and cost. It allows us to work within the limited land supply. All of the easy ground has been long ago developed. There are very few large undeveloped vacant parcels anywhere, particularly in Springfield. We're really looking at opportunities. This is a strategy for infill and redevelopment. It's very smart. It's limited impact on consuming additional resources. Living in close proximity to where streets and utilities and infrastructure already exists makes the overall cost of that particular additional housing unit less, makes the overall cost of the community less. And it also makes smaller homes available. So in this, one other thing is that this code amendment also fosters a sense of community, that we're all in this together. We want to work together where we can to help our fellow Springfield residents and neighbors and family members and loved ones find a place to live, to afford to have a place to live, and to be able to stay in Springfield when they want to. Two last points. One is that we have to maintain what capacity we do have in our available land supply. And within your code amendment before you, there are proposed standards that will help you maintain supply by not dropping below the minimum density in the MDU and the HDU zones. Those are important so that we maintain, at the very least, if one or more ADUs is proposed, depending on the lot size, et cetera, is filled out in the code amendment, it ensures that those minimum densities will be maintained. And lastly, design matters. Really, design is very important for the quality of life. And there's a number of requirements and standards within the code amendment that speak indirectly as well as directly to design. But it also allows flexibility in design, and flexibility in size, and in entrance, and in parking, and in doors and windows and trim and materials. So there's a certain amount of certainty, and there's a certain amount of flexibility, and it's speaking to design in terms of the neighborhood fit, and that's very important. So we appreciate, I and my colleagues have chatted about this in the office. We really do appreciate your effort, and keep up the good work. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Great. Okay, at this time, I'd like to ask Michael Carrington to step forward and address the commission.
Okay.
Carrigan?
Yes, Carrigan.
Carrigan?
Yes, my name is Michael Carrigan. I live at 1439 West 4th Street in Eugene. I'm here kind of testifying as the staff support for the Springfield Shelter Rights Alliance. And I also want to thank Sandy Belson and the other staff for a great plan. I think you should really support this plan. And one thing I like about it, the other speakers are saying, it's an innovative and flexible plan, and we need that today. I've been involved with homeless advocacy work throughout Lane County, and boy, there's such a huge demand now for affordable housing. And this plan will help deal with that. What I like about it is innovative and flexible plan, and that's really important. I'm on the board of the Square One Village, which has been building the rest stops in Eugene. And the one that I think relevant here is Emerald Village, which they are buying. Some people call them tiny houses, but I call them smaller houses. But we've had architects design these houses, and I'd love to see more of that. See those in Springfield as well. I mean, they're just beautiful. I urge you to go to check that out. It's a model not just for Springfield, but I think for the entire country. And this plan would enable things like that to happen. I would love to see some of these accessory dwelling units that have some really cutting-edge, innovative designs for those as well. I think downtown urban Springfield is a beautiful place, and the accessory dwellings would make it, I think, even a more beautiful place to live in. And finally, just as advocate for the homeless, anything you can do to give people more options is critically, critically important. It'll send a message out that Springfield is a welcome place for those who may not have a lot of money, who need housing, but not just coming up with some, a crappy piece of housing, but some like they're doing in Emerald Village and with the accessory dwelling units, something that the city could be really, really proud of. So thank you.
Thank you so much. Okay, Jackie Chandler, please. Jackie, state your name and address, please.
Hi, my name's Jackie Chandler, 1105 West Fairview, Springwater, Oregon. Thank you for letting me speak out. That's always my problem.
You can move that closer to you.
Hi, good evening. I'm actually addressing in favor of this change for the waivers. A couple of things for our family specific. We have a son that's handicapped, and he's adult, and it's really tough to find affordable housing for handicapped folks. We have an acre of land in the city limits, and we would like to see a couple things waived and worked on, and the restrictions loosened up. One, the appearance, I don't think should necessarily need to match the house in front of it. We have enough land that we can build further back in our acre, and far enough back that you wouldn't even be able to see it from the street, yet have a well-done lodging for him. And parking, as a lot of handicapped folks aren't able to do, he doesn't drive. So that wouldn't really, maybe there could be something put in there for parking issues that you don't necessarily need parking for people that are handicapped. Maybe address it on some level. And we would just like to be in support of this way.
Thank you. All right, and my last person in favor is Brianna. Can you help me with the last name? Nicolello.
Yeah.
Did I get it right?
Yeah.
All right.
There's like four bells in there, a bunch of vowels. So hello there, my name is Bree Nicolello, and I live at 831 West 5th Avenue, Apartment B, Eugene, Oregon, 97402. I'm usually tagging along with Rick Satry, but I'm here today on behalf of myself, and I come to you as someone deeply invested in land use issues, both personally as a renter and professionally as a planner in the private sector. I'm in favor of these code amendments, and I am so proud to see Springfield leading the way on affordable housing issues. The code amendments in front of you today are some of the most progressive in Oregon. Considering our housing crisis, these proposed amendments have the potential to make a tremendous impact on both the economic mobility of Springfield homeowners and on the lack of housing supply in Springfield. And Ms. Belson already went thoroughly through how that relates to all the comprehensive planning work that you've been giving so much time to throughout the last few years. While it may seem like a lot of new development is getting built, apartments not associated with the student housing market had an overall vacancy rate of 3% in 2016. What we have is simply not enough. Most in-demand areas are those with lesser unit supply competition, including parts of Springfield, reported a 0 to 2% vacancy rate last year. Accessory dwelling units tackle this pervasive issue by adding infill to single-family neighborhoods and higher intensity neighborhoods in a way that integrates with the existing neighborhood while still increasing density. Moreover, homeowners are able to increase the impact of their home investment by adding an additional property for rent. These units can be used for loved ones to age in place, as we heard earlier, or for young professionals like myself to live while getting on their feet in the community. In this sense, we are also building community, as Rick said, through the provision of more inclusive and accessible housing. While many cities allow for accessory dwelling units in their code, the requirements are so stringent or the SDC so expensive, these units are still built at low rates. And that's why I urge you to accept the code amendments as they are. These amendments take a holistic perspective on issues such as parking, tiny homes on wheels, which is currently a gray area, homeowners living on site, a provision that we are all happy to see, I think, be removed, and zoning where accessory dwelling units are allowed and increasing that beyond certain zones. These criteria, the stringent criteria, while often well-intentioned, can create barriers for homeowners to take full advantage of their property and build accessory dwelling units.
We also can have a habit of trying to solve issues best left to code inspection and enforcement through land use, which can exacerbate the barriers associated with development of more affordable housing. So Springfield has shown that it is a leader on issues of land use and housing. I'm proud to have projects in the city of Springfield and be able to contribute to this incredible community. We're at an exciting time. Let's keep the momentum moving forward. Thank you so much for all you do for this community.
Thank you. Wow, that was 3 minutes on the button. How was that?
Well trained.
I have no request to speak for testimony opposing the proposal at this time. Have we received any others or any neutral? So we have neither of those. Time for our questions from the commission. I think there were, I think the presentation was done well, and I think Sandy addressed several things, but what I heard was a couple of things. Number one, we have quite a bit of late arriving information that staff, I think, probably needs time to digest a bit. This is, in my opinion, a very progressive, forward-thinking change. And that does not surprise me at all that Springfield is on the forefront of this. However, with this level of change, and we will be discussing this, you know, it may be advantageous to leave the window open a little longer for public comment, and we can talk about that as we move forward. So at this time, I open it up to the commission. For any questions you might have from staff. Questions? Yes.
Not too much a question, but
Commissioner Gross.
First of all, you provided us with very thorough and detailed reports, and I appreciate that, and I think we all appreciate the detail that you've gone through, so thank you. And secondly, a comment is that at the time that this project and this work reaches the City Council, I hope it's your intention to include the comments that came from your open house as part of that report.
Yes, correct. So all of the public comments starting with C1, they'll all be labeled and they'll just accumulate C1, C2, everything else that comes in. And that would all be forwarded to the Council along with your public, along with your recommendation.
The reason I brought that up is that I'm looking through these comments, and I imagine some of the people that were at the open house are probably here tonight. There's a lot of positive comments, and I think a lot of these comments reinforce some of the thoughts and concepts that have came forward as the process is involved. So I think this is good reinforcement to go by the council. So that's the reason I was asking. Thank you.
Okay. Any others?
I did send a letter to you about a couple of issues. In general, I'm extremely supportive of what we're doing here. I think it's a really, really good thing for all the reasons that many of the commenters have made. However, I'm still a little concerned with the aesthetics and parking. And I think I've spelled those out pretty clearly in that letter. And I'm going to recommend that staff take a little closer look at those and see if there's a little bit more we can accomplish with that. I'm also very supportive of the idea that under aesthetics, that the director could review, if we do decide on an exact stringent code for windows and trim and siding and stuff, that the director would be able to review a proposal that did not meet those requirements and decide, is that in keeping with a desirable ADU or not, rather than being completely stringent and, in my feeling, restricting property owners' rights to go with a design of which they might be more comfortable.
However, and I think Christina pointed to the fact that it would require, because it's not if it's not prescriptive in the code, and there's discretion, there, it would need to go through an additional process. Is that correct?
Correct. So currently, accessory dwelling units are reviewed under a Type 1 procedure in the development code, and Type 1 procedure is a ministerial decision that involves the application of clear and objective standards only that don't involve any discretion. And so those are not considered land use decisions or limited land use decisions that are appealable to the Land Use Board of Appeals. If there was a pathway for a discretionary review on the part of the planning director, that would be a Type 2 limited land use decision, and that would be appealable to the Planning Commission on the whole application. It would not just be the director's determination on that particular window trim issue or whatever the design standard was, but that would elevate that whole application into a Type 2 decision that would be appealable to the Planning Commission and then to the Land Use Board of Appeals. So there are process implications, and it's up to the Planning Commission, I think, whether you think that's desirable or not and the extent to which you want to address that.
So by including language, just for clarity here, that would give discretionary decision making to the director, even if they did not elect to utilize that discretion, it still would push it to a Type 2 decision or not?
I think there's sort of two part answer. The first part is that under the needed housing statutes, we have to give them we have to provide a clear and objective standard that somebody can meet. So we have to give them the alternative to match what's existing or a certain trim dimension. The alternative, I think, depending on the way that we structure the code, the alternative design review could be something that's elevated to Type 2 only when it's only when that's elected, but it would elevate the entire ADU approval to that level of review. So even aspects of the decision that may be under clear and objective standards would be reviewable by the Planning Commission on appeal and LUBA on appeal. So it would not just be that one aspect of a particular decision.
Okay.
Commissioner?
Yes.
So I envision one option as a way to address that, and that would be if you wanted to have the clear and objective path be fairly limited, the accessory dwelling would be required to match the primary dwelling. So if it did not match the primary dwelling and you wanted to have that discretionary review, which would also allow for neighbors to comment, because part of that limited land use decision, we would send notice out to the surrounding property owners and they could comment. Then you could get into more discretionary standards in terms of being compatible with the neighborhood. So that would be one option I could see where you say it matches the primary dwelling, or you go through this limited land use decision with neighborhood comment. What we were trying to do was set clear and objective standards that would allow you to either match or something else. But if that or something else is too loose for you, or and you want to have that discretionary path, then that would be an option for you.
Or you could keep the language as you have it now with the clear and objective standards that include not just matching mm-hmm. the existing house and have a discretionary Type 2 included as well. Am I not correct?
Yes, you could. I think we would want to be clear that there is a reason to have that discretionary path. In other words, would there be situations that people would want to create something that doesn't comply with the standards we're providing?
And I would agree with that. I think we need to have solid, clear, and objective standards for individuals who want that Type 1 path and can get through that process fairly simply to move forward. I think there is a real desire to see a straightforward path. However, there will be times when I believe as people begin to develop these, as owners begin to develop these, that they may run into situations where there does need to be discretion and they may choose a Type 2 path, and I think we ought to support that as well. I think that makes a lot of sense. Does that make sense?
It does.
Okay. So is that a major revision to what you have here, or does what you're currently proposing get us there?
We'd have to make some revisions to get you there.
Okay.
I think what would be helpful, if you have any thoughts on, for example, the window question. For example, as Commissioner Koivula was saying, we could have you match or you meet this standard, or if you don't do either of those, then you go to the alternative process. So in terms of windows, for example, would you want something to have, like, well, you can either match or have a 3.5 inch trim? And then also a question is, are you concerned about the privacy aspect? So if we had some direction on how to approach the design, and then also that privacy thing, which was not a public comment, it was just something that came out as I was thinking about windows at your request, that I thought I'd bring forward for your consideration.
Thoughts? Yes.
In regard to this issue of window size and orientation, I know that it was suggested at one of our earlier meetings to strike out a portion of what had been proposed. And I have had to consider that I am opposed to striking this language. And the concern that I have is that if you don't have some kind of limitations on window size and orientation, you could have the possibility of having a large primary structure and an ADU that both have street exposure, and you have a large primary unit with small windows and a small ADU with large windows, if you allow those options to exist. So I'm more in favor of some restrictions on those issues, because I think one of the features of all of this work is compatibility between the primary unit and the ADU. And I think with eliminating this language or this particular part of the provision D would open up possibilities that may not be desirable.
Would you like to respond to that, staff, or no? Others? Yes. So I get what you're saying, Tim. I think that the situation where you have non-matching how primary and secondary dwelling can be an issue, I think that we should allow for some level of flexibility above the old language. I feel there's something in the middle there, because if you have really small windows on the front of your house, which is my experience, if you want to have slightly larger windows, I don't see a reason that should be completely banned. But I do understand what you're saying, giant windows, odd windows, maybe we could try to work around that, but I don't want to completely ban the option to have nicer windows on your secondary dwelling.
Well, I might... you hear kind of where the commission is landing on this. I think what the concern is primarily, something that looks compatible, somewhat compatible. And I think you've tried to do this. I think one side, you showed a picture of an accessory dwelling unit that was substantially different than the existing structure. And maybe if you could pull that up for us, just to look at that. In a situation like this, someone has been very innovative. And what I heard and what resonated with me when we had some public comment tonight, and thank you, public, for speaking, was innovation and flexibility. I think those two things resonated in several of folks that spoke to us. And I think, you know, within this structure of discretionary or non-discretionary prescriptive, I think we still need to have enough ability to be innovative. And I know that is, that's a fine line to walk. That's a tough line to walk. But I think that's what your commission is grappling with. That, you know, this under, in terms of what we have in front of us tonight, this example would be a type 2 process example. Is that correct?
Well, before you tonight, I mean, we haven't proposed a type 2 process.
Yes.
So,
I mean, but this would not meet the standard that we have in front of us tonight.
Well, it has the roof slope. It doesn't have the trim because we would require a 3.5-inch trim around the door. I think there is trim on the window, but it's hard to tell. So I would say if the doors and windows had the trim, it would meet the standard.
So I think this is a good example because, you know, this to me, you know, that is an older primary dwelling unit, and this ADU is fresh and bright, and that looks like a roll-up garage door on the end. Is that correct? On the end facing?
Yes.
So that's very innovative. Certainly you could incorporate solar, you could do lots of things with a unit like that. And what I'm hearing you say is generally that would meet the standard other than the trim.
Right. I mean, I guess it depends on whether we're counting the windows shall match in terms of height and width ratio and orientation. So in that sense, no, it doesn't. But I had heard from you last time that you wanted to consider removing that. So if we removed the height and width ratio, and the only requirement for windows was the trim, then this would match. If you maintained that height width ratio, then it would not.
And I think that's where we're having a little disagreement amongst the commission. So, yes.
Well, I think it's reaching a point where the idea of compatibility as a philosophical issue is kind of going out the window, because if we open up to very options that really don't present compatibility, then there might not even be any consideration of that as an issue at all.
When I think a question, you know, as we're trying to struggle with this, is are we wanting it to be compatible in terms of street view? Are we wanting it to be compatible in terms of view from the neighbors? I mean, from whose viewpoint? So I think if we agreed on some of that, that might help me go back and come up with some options. Because I think if you look at this example, this picture is taken from an interior of the lot. And so the surrounding neighbors probably aren't seen.
Probably not even visible from the street.
And not visible from the street, although I'm not sure. I can't tell, you know, where that garage door is. Was that a driveway at one point that you could see? I'm not sure. But so if we are looking at compatibility, from whose viewpoint are we looking at it from? And maybe we could craft some language around that.
Yes.
Sure. Yeah, the feeling in reading this, and perhaps correct me if I'm wrong, but you know, a lot of the window stuff about which way they face and whatnot was more really to protect the neighbor's privacy. And, you know, the design is so that somebody doesn't pull up a piece of junk to basically devalue the entire neighborhood. You have this small thing that still looks nice, and I think my feeling is, as long as we're doing those two things, we're protecting the neighbor's privacy and we're not installing a piece of junk, I favor staying flexible. I don't, to be honest, I don't really care about 3.5-inch trim.
Okay. Others?
I mean, I think this has been a fun process, and it seems like the public support is here. And being flexible and allowing it, like Andrew said, it doesn't have to necessarily be exactly a Craftsman style, but as long as it's well made, built, and up to code, then yeah, people should be able to do it.
Well, I generally err on the side of some flexibility. I think it is important to protect the privacy of the neighbors and to stay, you know, in alignment with the property, the primary property. But I think flexibility is great. I actually like what you've done here. I think it's a good starting point for us with the additions that you've provided. I think it's a place to start. I think we're going to be like any other code change. We will learn more over time, and I think that is part of why we're here, is to allow make some decisions that are tough decisions. And do our best not to degrade the neighborhoods, but also give some flexibility so that folks can develop and begin to use and access these ADUs for many of the reasons that were stated clearly tonight. So I would be in favor of the revisions that you provided us. I think I would like to see the addition of the language that the Fair Housing Council discussed related to Goal 10 findings. I think those are the things that I'm primarily interested in. Others? Okay. So, summation of staff. I know it's a gray. Kind of a mucky mess right now, but you have good information you provided to us, and we have additional testimony that's been provided tonight that I'm sure staff will more want to formally respond to. I think, in my humble opinion, I think it's important that we allow the time to do our best to get it right. I think it would be a good thing for us to leave the public record open for a time. I would propose October 27th, there's a lot of interest in the community. I also know that folks would like to get this moving forward, but I think we're on an excellent path. Staff has done an incredible job. I think that leaving the record open until the 27th would be beneficial for public to give any additional comments that they have, also give the commission an opportunity and staff an opportunity to deal with some of the things that have been brought forward tonight. And then I think the public hearing, I think we probably should leave open until Wednesday, November 8th, come back and deliberate on.
So you can't close the record prior to the public hearing closing. If you're continuing the public hearing through November 8th, then the record automatically stays open through that public hearing. And also, because this is legislative, you would have the option to close the hearing tonight. There will be an addition, I just want to clarify, because it's not quasi-judicial, you have the option to leave the record open and through your next session anyway, even if you were to decide to close the hearing tonight. Okay, but you may continue the public hearing in November, and that's certainly your option.
It's November 7th.
Well, but the 7th is election day, we might choose to do it on the 8th.
If this room is available, if you guys are available in the community.
All right. So what legal counsel has said is the written record would if we kept the public hearing open, the written record would remain open?
You would technically continue the public hearing until that date, and the record would automatically stay open.
Correct. I just want to make sure that staff has time to deal with the information that's been provided to us, and also deal with the request from the Fair Housing Council related to Gold 10 fundings. I think that piece supports the action as well.
Sure. I would say that in terms of deciding whether to leave the hearing, to continue the hearing or close the hearing, I mean, people can provide comments. I do think you should leave the record open for all the reasons you've talked about. I think we can provide some more information about the parking, for example. We can provide some more options on design. The question for you is whether you want people to be able to speak to you again in November, or if you want to just take the written comments that would be brought before you that night or in your pocket if we got them in time.
I'd recommend to keep the public hearing open, because I think that we've seen an awful lot of community interest in this. And with the discussions we've had tonight, I'm sure that many people are thinking about this right now and probably have additional things to tell us just as a result of this evening's discussion.
So. What I heard you say is the written record could stay open, right? So we could close the hearing tonight, and then reconvene on November 8th and deliberate. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, and if I understand it correctly, could have received further written communication from anybody regarding anything between now and then, having closed the public hearing but continued the written record. So. Further thoughts could be.
Could you use the mic, please?
Excuse me. So further thoughts could be submitted, could be reviewed. Closing the public hearing but leaving the written record open, is my understanding.
Are we on track?
Yes. And you have the option to leave the written record open up to the time that your next regular meeting starts. You don't have to give the 7 days in between for the applicant to rebut that you would normally do in a quasi-judicial.
So we have two options before us. We can either leave the public hearing open, or we can close the public hearing. We can leave the written record open, which I think we have general consensus on. And the question would be when you might leave the written record open until to receive additional information. I think that I would tend to want the written record to remain open long enough, but I would also like staff to be able to have time to respond to anything received in the written record prior to us meeting again and deliberating. Is that reasonable?
I think to clarify, if there were something to be received in the interim period, if you closed on October 27th, for example, and you reconvene on November 8th, any comments submitted from the public between that gap time would be forwarded on to City Council and would be included in their record, but you would not have those comments before you for your consideration.
Yeah. That makes sense. City Council is going to hold a public hearing as well. I mean, our recommendation eventually will be to either forward to City Council as is or with revisions or so. Yes, Commissioner Landon.
I was going to ask if we're going to keep the written record open, is there a downside to keeping the public hearing open as well?
Well, it's just that the written record will stay open until we reconvene, and staff then often would not have time to respond to anything that comes in related to the written record if we leave the hearing open. Does that make sense? So I would suggest that we leave the written record open until Friday, October 27th, and that we close the public hearing
and we reconvene to deliberate on November 8th. Does that make sense, Christine?
Yes.
Right?
I think that's a good idea.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
All right. So, so I would move to close the public hearing at this time.
Second.
Who seconded?
Okay. Okay. It's been moved by Commissioner James, seconded by Commissioner Sherwood to close the public hearing at this time. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? I would also move to leave the written record open for additional written evidence, arguments, or testimony until Friday, October 27th. All those in
favor? At 5 p.m.?
At 5 p.m. Thank you. All those in favor, or excuse me, I heard a second by Commissioner Sherwood, I believe. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. All right. So so at this time, we will move on, I suppose. And we will take in additional written comment and testimony and until 5 p.m. on Friday, October 27th. And then we will reconvene and deliberate on Wednesday, November 8th, if the room is open, right? Or if not, we'll be someplace else. Okay? All right. Okay, reports of council action. Yes?
I was going to say, I heard we have a continuing plan commissioner.
Yeah, I guess I got to move forward last night, so
excellent.
On for another 4 years.
We're stuck with them.
Congratulations, Commissioner Nelson.
That's my Commissioner Nelson.
Yeah, that's your report.
What the hell in the world did that happen?
Okay, other reports. Commissioner Bowes, did you have a report?
Yes, on October 9, the council session, that was a work session with three items. This was a meeting that extended for 3.5 hours, so the council has been pretty busy lately. The first item of three was interviews for membership on the Bicycle Pedestrian Committee, and there were 12 interviews that took place during that meeting, so Andy, I think your committee is going to have a lot of new faces. It's been left pretty much to staff as to how to determine who gets what role as far as the length of term, because there's either a two-year option or a three-year option of term length, so that not everyone stacks up at the same ending date. So that was the majority of the time for the meeting. And then the second agenda item was a presentation on economic development strategy. And the presentation originally had 10 different items that they wanted to touch on, because the length of the meeting that had already taken place, they cut it down to about three, so there will be another additional meeting some point in the future to continue this same agenda item. But some of the topics that were discussed were community livability, job growth, infrastructure improvements, and economic development. And then the third and last agenda item was a Chamber of Commerce work ready sponsorship item, and much of what they discussed was the same as what had been discussed in agenda item number two, but the additional information was the fact that the chamber is working with students in the schools in regard to trying to tailor students' interests to the availability of jobs in the future, rather than having people interested in jobs that are tended to be more dead end and have less of a future. So that was their presentation to conclude the meeting.
Okay. Any other reports? Hearing none. Any business from planning manager?
No, sir.
Okay. All right. We stand adjourned.
Project.